Chapter 35. Love the Emperor. The thought of that sublime hero chained to a rock in the middle of a savage ocean makes life of so little value that I would receive with positive joy your instructions to blow my brains out. From suicide I consider myself an honor debarred. But I keep a loaded pistol in my drawer. Madame la Générale d'Hubert lifted up her hands in despair after perusing that answer. You see? He won't be reconciled, said her husband. He must never, by any chance, be allowed to guess where the money comes from. It wouldn't do. He couldn't bear it. You are a brave homme, Armand, said Madame la Générale, appreciatively. My dear, I had the right to blow his brains out, but as I didn't, we can't let him starve. He has lost his pension, and he is utterly incapable of doing anything in the world for himself. We must take care of him, secretly, to the end of his days. Don't I owe him the most ecstatic moment of my life? Dot 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 ha! 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 Over the fields, 2 miles, running all the way. I couldn't believe my ears. Dot dot dot, but for his stupid ferocity, it would have taken me years to find you out. It's extraordinary how in one way or another this man has managed to fasten himself on my deeper feelings. A pathetic tale, Illinois Cond, Vedi Napoli Epoi Mori. The first time we got into conversation was in the National Museum in Naples, in the rooms on the ground floor containing the famous collection of bronzes from Herculaneum and Pompeii. That marvelous legacy of antique art whose delicate perfection has been preserved for us by the catastrophic fury of a volcano. He addressed me first, over the celebrated resting Hermes which we had been looking at side by side. He said the right things about that wholly admirable piece. Nothing profound. His taste was natural rather than cultivated. He had obviously seen many fine things in his life and appreciated them. But he had no jargon of a dilettante or the connoisseur. A hateful tribe. He spoke like a fairly intelligent man of the world, a perfectly unaffected gentleman. We had known each other by sight for some few days past. Staying in the same hotel good, but not extravagantly up to date, I had noticed him in the vestibule going in and out. I judged he was an old and valued client. The beau of the hotel keeper was cordial in its deference, and he acknowledged it with familiar courtesy. For the servants he was ill-conned. There was some squabble over a man's parasol, yellow silk with white lining sort of thing the waiters had discovered abandoned outside the dining room door. Our gold-laced doorkeeper recognized it and I heard him directing one of the lift boys to run after ill-conned with it. Perhaps he was the only count staying in the hotel, or perhaps he had the distinction of being the count par excellence, conferred upon him, because of his tried fidelity to the house. Having conversed at the Museo and by the by he had expressed his dislike of the busts and statues of Roman emperors in the gallery of marbles. Their faces were too vigorous, too pronounced for him. Having conversed already in the morning, I did not think I was intruding when in the evening, finding the dining room very full, I proposed to share his little table. Judging by the quiet urbanity of his consent, he did not think so either. His smile was very attractive. He dined in an evening waistcoat, and a moking, he called it so, with a black tie. All this of very good cut, not new just as these things should be. He was, morning or evening, very correct in his dress. I have no doubt that his whole existence had been correct, well-ordered and conventional, undisturbed by startling events. His white hair brushed upwards off a lofty forehead gave him the air of an idealist, of an imaginative man. His white mustache, heavy but carefully trimmed and arranged, was not unpleasantly tinted a golden yellow in the middle. The faint scent of some very good perfume, and of good cigars, that last an odor quite remarkable to come upon in Italy, reached me across the table. It was in his eyes that his age showed most. They were a little weary with creased eyelids. He must have been 60, or a couple of years more. And he was communicative. I would not go so far as to call it garrulous, but distinctly communicative. He had tried various climates, of Abasia, of the Riviera, of other places too, he told me, but the only one which suited him was the climate of the Gulf of Naples. The ancient Romans, who, he pointed out to me, were men expert in the art of living, knew very well what they were doing when they built their villas on these shores, in Baiae, in Vico, in Capri. They came down to the seaside in search of health, bringing with them their trains of mimes and flute players to amuse their leisure. He thought it extremely probable that the Romans of the higher classes were specially predisposed to painful rheumatic affections. This was the only personal opinion I heard him express. It was based on no special erudition. He knew no more of the Romans than an average informed man of the world is expected to know. He argued from personal experience. He had suffered himself from a painful and dangerous rheumatic affection till he found relief in this particular spot of southern Europe. This was 3 years ago, and ever since he had taken up his quarters on the shores of the Gulf, either in one of the hotels in Sorrento or hiring a small villa in Capri. He had a piano, a few books, picked up transient acquaintances of a day, week, or month in the stream of travelers from all Europe. One can imagine him going out for his walks in the streets and lanes, becoming known to beggars, shopkeepers, children, country people, talking amiably over the walls to the contadini and coming back to his rooms or his villa, to sit before the piano, with his white hair brushed up and his thick orderly mustache, to make a little music for myself. And, of course, for a change there was Naples' nearby life, movement, animation, opera. A little amusement, as he said, is necessary for health. Mimes and flute players, in fact. Only unlike the magnates of ancient Rome, he had no affairs of the city to call him away from these moderate delights. He had no affairs at all. Probably he had never had any grave affairs to attend to in his life. It was a kindly existence, with its joys and sorrows regulated by the course of nature, marriages, births, deaths ruled by the prescribed usages of good society and protected by the state. He was a widower, but in the months of July and August he ventured to cross the Alps for 6 weeks on a visit to his married daughter. He told me her name. It was that of a very aristocratic family. She had a castle in Bohemia, I think. This is as near as I ever came to ascertaining his nationality. His own name, strangely enough, he never mentioned. Perhaps he thought I had seen it on the published list. Truth to say, I never looked. At any rate, he was a good European. He spoke four languages to my certain knowledge and a man of fortune. Not of great fortune, evidently and appropriately. I imagine that to be extremely rich would have appeared to him improper, outre too blatant altogether. And obviously too, the fortune was not of his making. The making of a fortune cannot be achieved without some roughness. It is a matter of temperament. His nature was too kindly for strife. In the course of conversation he mentioned his estate quite by the way, in reference to that painful and alarming rheumatic affection. One year, staying incautiously beyond the Alps as late as the middle of September, he had been laid up for 3 months in that lonely country house with no one but his valet and the caretaking couple to attend to him. Because, as he expressed it, he kept no establishment there. He had only gone for a couple of days to confer with his land agent. He promised himself never to be so imprudent in the future. The first weeks of September Temer would find him on the shores of his beloved Gulf. Sometimes in traveling one comes upon such lonely men, whose only business is to wait for the unavoidable. Deaths and marriages have made a solitude round them, and one really cannot blame their endeavors to make the waiting as easy as possible. As he remarked to me, at my time of life freedom from physical pain is a very important matter. It must not be imagined that he was a wearisome hypochondriac. He was really much too well-bred to be a nuisance. He had an eye for the small weaknesses of humanity. But it was a good-natured eye. He made a restful, easy, pleasant companion for the hours between dinner and bedtime. We spent 3 evenings together, and then I had to leave Naples in a hurry to look after a friend who had fallen seriously ill in Taormina. Having nothing to do, Il Conte came to see me off at the station. I was somewhat upset, and his idleness was always ready to take a kindly form. He was by no means an indolent man. He went along the train peering into the carriages for a good seat for me, and then remained talking cheerily from below. He declared he would miss me that evening very much, and announced his intention of going after dinner to listen to the band in the public garden, the Villa di Zionale. He would amuse himself by hearing excellent music and looking at the best society. There would be a lot of people, as usual. I seemed to see him, yet his raised face with a friendly smile under the thick mustaches, and his kind, fatigued eyes. As the train began to move, he addressed me in 2 languages. First in French, saying, "Bon voyage," then, in his very good, somewhat emphatic English, encouragingly, "because he could see my concern, all will be well yet." My friend's illness having taken a decidedly favorable turn, I returned to Naples on the 10th day. I cannot say I had given much thought to Il Conte during my absence, but entering the dining room I looked for him in his habitual place. I had an idea he might have gone back to Sorrento to his piano, and his books and his fishing. He was great friends with all the boatmen, and fished a good deal with lines from a boat. But I made out his white head in the crowd of heads, and even from a distance noticed something unusual in his attitude. Instead of sitting erect, gazing all round with alert urbanity, he drooped over his plate. I stood opposite him for some time, before he looked up, a little wildly, if such a strong word can be used in connection with his correct appearance. "Ah, my dear sir, is it you?" he greeted me. "I hope all is well." He was very nice about my friend. Indeed, he was always nice, with the niceness of people whose hearts are genuinely humane. But this time it cost him an effort. His attempts at general conversation broke down into dullness. It occurred to me he might have been indisposed. But before I could frame the inquiry he muttered, "You find me here very sad." "I am sorry for that," I said. "Why, you haven't had bad news, I hope?" "It was very kind of me to take an interest." "No, it was not that. No bad news, thank God." And he became very still, as if holding his breath. Then, leaning forward a little, and in an odd tone of odd embarrassment, he took me into his confidence. "The truth is that I have had an abominable adventure happen to me." The energy of the epithet was sufficiently startling in that man of moderate feelings and toned-down vocabulary. The word unpleasant I should have thought would have fitted amply the worst experience likely to befall a man of his stamp. And an adventure too. Incredible. But it is in human nature to believe the worst, and I confess I eyed him stealthily, wondering what he had been up to. In a moment, however, my unworthy suspicions vanished. There was a fundamental refinement of nature about the man which made me dismiss all idea of some more or less disreputable scrape. "It is very serious. Very serious," he went on, nervously. I will tell you after dinner, if you will allow me." I expressed my perfect acquiescence by a little bow, nothing more. I wished him to understand that I was not likely to hold him to that offer, if he thought better of it later on. We talked of indifferent things, but with a sense of difficulty quite unlike our former easy, go-sipy intercourse. The hand raising a piece of bread to his lips, I noticed, trembled slightly. This symptom, in regard to my reading of the man, was no less than startling. In the smoking room he did not hang back at all. Directly we had taken our usual seats, he leaned sideways over the arm of his chair, and looked straight into my eyes earnestly. You remember, he began, that day you went away? I told you then I would go to the Villanese Ale to hear some music in the evening. I remembered. His handsome old face, so fresh for his age, unmarked by any trying experience, appeared haggard for an instant. It was like the passing of a shadow. Returning his steadfast gaze, I took a sip of my black coffee. He was systematically minute in his narrative, simply in order, I think, not to let his ex. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.